All right. So, we are dealing with Joseph at this time. And last week we were looking at the exaltation of Joseph. And so, just briefly, I just put it all up on the screen at once, so go through it very quickly. You see those five ceremonial steps that Pharaoh took. And again, Pharaoh is just trying to make sure that people recognize the authority that that he has, because all of this is happening very quickly. And of course, they would, in order for him to get the job done, do what the Pharaoh wants him to do with regard to the famine and everything, his authority has to be recognized pretty quickly. And so as he goes all through Egypt and doing the things that he needs to. And so obviously Pharaoh went to great lengths here in a rather rapid time, gave him a ring, a robe. I put on their royal linen. It doesn't specifically say robe, but it was a distinctive garment that would separate him, a rank, a ride, and a reputation. And the reputation there having to do with the name. You remember chapter 41, again at verse 45, and Pharaoh called Joseph's name Saphnath-Phaneah, or Paneah, rather. And he gave him to marry Asenath. And we talked about that just in closing briefly. A lot of people have just big problems with that because it says she's the daughter of Potiphar's priest of On. And I was just mentioning, no need to make that big of a deal of that. But that would really mean that she probably was an adulteress because he was the priest at On. That was the center of the god of the sun, there, Ray. And that was a group of priests. Different priests had different ranks, and the priests at On were very prestigious and had a lot of power and clout. And so, you know, the fact that she is his daughter, she probably was a worshiper of the sun god. And so people have a problem with that. That wouldn't be an ideal situation for a servant of God to enter into. But again, Joseph, as I said in closing last week, I think he probably had no choice in the matter. Pharaoh, I mean, there's a reason why Pharaoh no doubt did this. He basically was marrying an aristocrat, which would put him automatic. Again, that would just emphasize his new position, his new authority, and he would be distinct from the common people because even of the family he married into. And so that was very significant. And again, he probably had no choice about it. The positive thing is that we don't read anything really about that with regard to Joseph. So that just tells us that she had zero influence on him if she was a worshiper of the sun god. And knowing Joseph, as we now do by this time, if anything, he influenced her. And that's just the way that situation turned out. And there's no need to make a big deal about that. And so all of those steps were taken. And again, what we see here then is this great exaltation of the man Joseph. And you just think again of all that we have seen, from thrown in a pit to being sold as a slave into Egypt, and then being thrown into prison, and now to be exalted to this position all over all of Egypt except for Pharaoh himself. It's really a magnificent thing that happens in a very short period of time. And so it's a wonderful thing. And when we think about what he has gone through, we understand God knows what he's doing. And he can work things out, can he? And the encouraging thing for us is we're not Joseph. And we're not going to be exalted in the way Joseph was. But like Joseph, we all have our troubles, don't we? We all have difficulties as Christians. We have problems from time to time. But we serve the same God Joseph did. The same God that exalted him, arranged him to be over all of Egypt, is the God that we serve. And just like he helped Joseph, providentially, he can help us and does help us. How many times has he helped us and gotten us through difficult times and difficult situations? And that's just the God that we serve, and we can count on that. Someone brought up, I think, I'm not quite sure if it was this class or another, but we're all familiar with Romans chapter 8 and what Paul said there in that great chapter in the Bible, Acts the 8th chapter, but verse 28, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. And that's us. And so that passage means something. We could take it to heart. All things work together for good. That doesn't mean we're not going to have difficulties and problems. That certainly was the case with Joseph. He had all kinds of difficulties. But in the end, all things work together for good. And with us, that doesn't necessarily mean, like, we're going to have some problems in life, and maybe there are some things that are never really resolved to our liking. But the one thing we know as God's people is, as long as we love the Lord, and as long as we don't waver, our relationship with God will remain intact. We'll continue to be in fellowship with him, and our soul will be secure. And that's the most important thing, isn't it? We think of Joseph putting on those new garments. We have in Christ new garments, don't we? And ultimately, from a figure standpoint, we'll be clothed with white robes. You remember over in Revelation chapter 3, where Jesus is speaking to the church at Sardis. Now, this church was a mess. They had a reputation that they were alive, but they were in reality dead. But there were a few at Sardis who continued to live the way God wanted them to live. Verse 4 of Revelation 3 says, yet you have still a few names in Sardis, people who have not soiled their garments, and they will walk with me in white, for they are worthy. The one who conquers will be clothed thus in white garments, and I will never blot his name out of the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. And that's true, really, about every one of us. As long as our names are written in that book of life, as long as we're conquerors, we conquer sin through Jesus Christ, of course, and the help of God's grace. We overcome sin. We stay away from living in sin and dwelling in sin. Then we'll have those robes of that are white, that are prepared for us. Again, from a figurative standpoint, turn over a couple of chapters to Revelation chapter 6 or chapter 7 rather. And you might remember that the passage here at verse 9, it says, and after this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. Down at verse 13, it said, one of the elders addressed me, saying, who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come? And I said to him, sir, you know. And he said to me, these are those coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And, of course, this great tribulation is not some seven-year period of time in the future, as some think. But really, he's talking about the tribulation of the Roman persecution that these individuals came out of. Now, you think about that. A lot of those Christians in those years when they were being persecuted, they lost their lives. But all things work together for good, nevertheless. They continued in fellowship with God and died in Christ, and now they have their white robes, and so were we. It doesn't mean everything will work out exactly the way we want, but all things do work together for good. And there is a sense, even, as we even think about the things of this world, that God is with us providentially and sees us through difficult times, not just for when we get to heaven, but even in the here and now. As I said a moment ago, how often do you know, can you think back in your life, difficult situations that God has seen you through? And I think all of us can look back and say, yes, I can pinpoint the different things that God has done for me, blessed me, and helped me through difficult times. And so that's a wonderful thing. And when we turn back over to the story of Joseph, we see that, this great exaltation after he was troubled for so long, being innocent and all of this, we see God finally exalts him. And so it's an encouraging situation. Well, back over to Genesis 41 then, going forward in the story. Verse 46 says, Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all of the land of Egypt. And you notice there, we've read several times where he is really over all the land of Egypt. I was reading somewhere where there are Bible critics who said, no, if you know anything about Egyptian history, and this is the problem with you Christians, basically, these Bible critics, you all Bible believers, you just mess up history and all that. And if you know anything about history, you know during this time that Egypt was divided. There wasn't one Pharaoh over everyone. And if you, what they're referring to is there's a period of time when a group of people called the Hyksos ruled over Egypt. And what they were, the word Hyksos simply means foreign rulers or rulers over a foreign land. And there's a time when they ruled Egypt for just about, well, it just depends on who you're listening to. If you listen to Josephus, he'll say 500 years. But it was probably closer to 100 years, maybe 150 years or so, that these individuals, they invaded Egypt and drove out the native Egyptians. And there's not a few Bible scholars who believe that all that happened during the time of Joseph, when Joseph was there. Well, if that's the case, then at that time when the Hyksos ruled, the kingdom was divided, and they only ruled what is called Lower Egypt. And that would actually be Northern Egypt. And then the other people ruled the Southern Egypt. And so Joseph would not have ruled over all the land. But even if that was the case, he would have ruled over the land that was a part of the territory of Egypt that he moved into, he was taken into, I should say, when he was enslaved. But there's a good possibility that the Hyksos didn't come until at the end of Joseph's life there. And one thing, a lot of that explains certain that whatever position you take, and scholars are divided when the Hyksos actually ruled the land. But a lot of it explains why was it that at the end of Genesis or the beginning of Exodus, that a Pharaoh rose that knew not Joseph. How did that happen? And a lot of times, as we're studying the Bible and even teaching Bible class, we'll kind of take the easy way out and say, well, the Pharaoh died and a new Pharaoh came along. And, right, well, that's an easy explanation. The only problem is the Egyptians were notorious for deifying all of the Pharaohs and making a big deal over any so-called celebrity, any national hero or anything like that who would die. There would be all kinds of things left behind indicating that that person would be held up and you see drawings about him and all that, and you don't read anything about Joseph in Egyptian history. Nothing. and so Bible critics are going to jump all over that. It's all made up. None of that happened. Nothing like that ever happened. But archaeologists have come up with things to indicate that Joseph was in Egypt. And then, not only that, if the Hyksos, it could be that if they came at the end of Joseph's life, and in fact, this would be true no matter when they came, really. If they, let's just say, many scholars say the Hyksos came and they were the people in charge during when Joseph was there. These foreigners, they would have, even though they weren't technically Egyptians, they spoke Egyptian language. Whenever they occupied that land, they spoke the language. They kept all of the customs intact. The only thing that may have been different was some political situation. So, you know, everybody would refer to them as Egyptians, except the native Egyptians. They would be Hyksos to them. But everyone else, they would be Egyptians. And the Bible often would do that sort of thing. If everybody thought of these foreign rulers as Egyptians, the Bible would use that language. I'll give you an example of that. In Acts chapter 4, you remember when the Bible refers to Annas as high priest? Remember that? They had arrested Peter and John and whatever, and they started naming and Annas the high priest. Well, he wasn't high priest. Caiaphas was high priest, and everybody knew that. But Annas was the high priest before Caiaphas, his son-in-law, became high priest. And he had so much respect that people still viewed him as high priest and respected him as high priest. So when you read it in the Word, it just refers to him as high priest, even though we know he wasn't high priest. And so, that sort of thing. We see that kind of thing in the Bible. It is, you know, language that just fits the region and the area. And so the Hyksos, they were known as Egyptians and spoke Egyptian language. So that's really no problem. That there are some issues with that, though, when you get into the text and read some of the things that we've already read. Like, one of the things that the Hyksos wouldn't have done, they, again, would keep the language and customs and that sort of thing. But who was Potiphar? Y'all know that. Who's Potiphar? What was Potiphar? He was captain of the guard. That was purely Egyptian. Like, the Hyksos, they called their rulers pharaohs too. But they would not put, they didn't use, you know, all the terminology. The captain of the guard would have been, and even, you know, Potiphar, Egyptian name, he would have been an Egyptian, and they would not have put an Egyptian in charge, most likely. And we think of things like, remember we talked about, what did Joseph do before he appeared before Pharaoh? He did what? He cleaned up and he shaved. Well, that was purely Egyptian, to shave. And remember I said that, you know, him putting on new clothes and all that, that was kind of his thing. But the shaving, the Egyptians did that. They didn't have any hair, you know, that they wanted. And so a lot of people think that the Hyksos, they don't know exactly where they came from, but a lot of people think they were Semitic, and therefore if they were, then that explains a couple of things. First of all, though, they would have hair on their face, and they wouldn't worry about, you know, the shaving part of it or anything like that. And if they were, that might even explain why they were so quick to elevate Joseph, because that's his background as well. But anyway, there's just, you know, either way you go, there's problems with that, but it does explain, no matter how you look at it, why it is, because what would have happened is the Hyksos lost their power. Eventually, the native Egyptians took over the land once again. And most scholars believe that would be, you know, right about the time of Exodus, the end of Genesis, Exodus. And so you would have, let's just say that if it was the Hyksos that were there and being driven out, the new Pharaoh king that came in, he wouldn't have any clue of who Joseph was. Like, that would be more than just one Pharaoh replacing another. It would be a group of conquered people reconquering the land, and you could see why they wouldn't have any record of Joseph or retain, they wouldn't care anything about Joseph. And the Pharaoh would know not Joseph. And so that would explain that little small biblical problem there. And that would be true no matter. Now, a lot of scholars, maybe not as many, but I think this group might have it right, that they believe it was the native Egyptians that were there when Joseph got in there, and the Hyksos came in. They're the ones that came in and enslaved the Israelites and so on and everything. Well, again, in that scenario, you see why the Pharaoh wouldn't know Joseph. So either way, it's very explainable. And And I really didn't mean to get bogged down in all of that. But I was just reading where on almost every turn, there's all kinds of things that you just have to be aware of. The Bible critics are going to constantly do what they can to prove that the Bible isn't right and it's not accurate. I didn't bring it up. I think the passage already passed. Wasn't it I'm not quite sure if it, maybe I've missed it, but was it when Pharaoh was having his dreams? Wasn't it his birthday or on that occasion? I think it was. But anyway, whenever that came up, a lot of Bible critics point out, well, you know, the Egyptians didn't celebrate birthdays. That's just historically wrong. And so, again, you Christians, you're just so gullible, you just accept anything. But if you really know your history of Egypt, Egyptian historians and those who know about that know that it was many hundreds of years later to where they had it celebrated birthdays and that sort of thing. Well, then, of course, what do you think happened? What do archaeologists do? They dig, and they finally come along, and they have discovered things that indicate that at that time, they did celebrate. But we have record of birthdays being celebrated. And so when these Bible critics, it seems like just give them enough time, and sooner or later, maybe it's providence of God or whatever, but sooner or later, you know, we're going to discover, no, you were wrong about that. You're wrong about this. But you know what they never, ever, ever find? Ever? Of all of the digs that have happened all through the time since that became a practice, archaeology, you know what? They have never discovered anywhere ever anything that contradicts the Bible. Not once. Nothing with regard to years or time, anything like that. The only thing they can always say is, well, yeah, but we haven't discovered this. And so, you know, the Bible can't be right. But they can't say, you see this? We discovered this. This contradicts the Bible. They've never found that. That's pretty interesting. That's a pretty powerful way of proving that the Bible is right, honestly. So, but anyway, with regard to this, with Joseph and who was ruling in the land, either way, we can make sense of it and make it so the Bible isn't contradicting itself. I would take the latter view because it does sound like here, like the Bible over and over says that Joseph was ruler over all of the land. But either way, it's explainable. All right. So again, just getting back in the text, it says during the seven plentiful years, verse 47, the earth produced abundantly. And he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt, and put food in the cities. And he put in every city the food from the fields around it. And Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. And so the dream is coming to fruition. What a wonderful situation here. The harvest is so fruitful, they can't even measure it. And most everything that happens with this story of Joseph is, it really is providential in nature. I'm not sure, but that wasn't a miraculous hand that God had involved in that. That it produced so much because it's preparing. They have to have enough so that they have enough food to last for 7 years afterwards. So, yeah. Yeah.
It was a celebration of his birthday, chapter 40.
Oh, okay. 20. Okay. Yes. Yes. Very good. Thank you. I thought I just read over that and didn't say anything about that. But very good. All right. So the dream is coming to fruition. And they have this great 7 years of plentiful. And they have more grain, more food that they can even measure. Then he says, before the year of the famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. It says, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. And even these names, it seems like this comes up a lot, like recently this has come up a lot. But remember, these names that people gave their children meant something in biblical times. And so it is with this. And we kind of get some insight into the mind of Joseph and just even how he felt during this whole time in Egypt. Because it's reflected in the names of his sons. Manasseh, he says, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardships. The Manasseh meant, the word meant to forget. And so he said, he named him Manasseh, for he said, God has made me to forget all my hardship and all my father's house. So Joseph had a hard time in Egypt, didn't he? He views his situation there, he reviews it as hardship. Even though, you know, we keep seeing that he's working hard, he doesn't forsake God, he doesn't waver, and God exalts him, you know, whether it was in Potiphar's house or in prison, or even now over all of Egypt, he's still away from home. And that's a hard situation. And we know he's had some physical hardships as well, but he views all of this as a hardship. And so he names his son Manasseh, because now God has made me forget not only the hardships, but all my father's house. How many times, how many nights do you think he spent thinking about back home? No matter how good things got. And then, especially during the troubling times, when it was real hard in prison in those first years there, as we saw, even torturous at first. How many times do you think he sat on his bed or whatever it is that he had as a resting place and thought about back home? Or when he first was chased out of Potiphar's house, or just through the whole thing. But he's kind of getting over it. And so he names his son Manasseh, which means, again, you have helped me to forget all the hardships and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And Ephraim meant, again, to be fruitful. And so he knew God is blessing me, even though he still refers to it as what? The land of my affliction. But God is blessing him. And he doesn't forget that. He recognizes that. And again, that's just something else with Joseph. We see that every step of the way. He never, ever forgets God. He gives God all the credit, all the glory. And he knows, yes, even though this is tough and I'm away from home and bad things have happened to me, God has blessed me. And because of him, I'm fruitful. And how many of us can take that same approach in life? We should, as Christians. We have been blessed in magnificent ways, and a lot of ways more even than Joseph. From a spiritual standpoint, all of the spiritual blessings that we enjoy in Christ every day. We might be in a land of affliction. We might have trouble in our life, but God helps us to be fruitful, and we ought to have that good attitude that Joseph had. Well, then it says, the 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come. As Joseph had said, there was famine in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. What he says to you, do. And so the famine had spread over all the land. Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt, to Joseph, to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. And so we see the exhortation of Joseph and the dreams that Pharaoh had coming to pass just the way God interpret them to come to pass. And so interesting here that again, it's not just Egypt, but all the lands came, were affected by this famine and came to Egypt. And so as we go forward then, we find Joseph's first meeting with his brothers. That's chapter 42. When you think about that, Joseph's a pretty smart guy, isn't he? Do you think he had an inclination that at some point in time his brothers might come to town. Everybody's coming from all the civilized world, at least the places affected by the famine. And the record says all the earth. You recognize that, again, in Bible terminology, that doesn't necessarily mean every square mile of the earth. But in all that region, all that area, that people are all through Canaan, all of the Canaan, they're all coming, and they need bread. And Joseph knows that. And, you know, there's no way, I mean, you know, God didn't say anything to him about this, so he couldn't know his brothers would come. But if you were Joseph, would you think, you know, my brothers may come to get some bread over here in Egypt? And of course, we find that's exactly what happens. So we get into chapter 42. And now we see the providence again kicking in. And really, God's providential plan is starting to really come about. Because remember, this whole thing, this isn't just about saving Joseph's family. That's the immediate crisis, of course, and saving Jacob and his offspring from the famine. But the larger picture is God has to get the descendants of Abraham to Egypt. And certainly it'd be a problem if they perish where they are, because the overall plan is the Messiah, the seed of Abraham, coming through the offspring of Abraham. That's the Abrahamic promise. Genesis 12, Genesis 18, Genesis 22. And so all of that has to happen. And so later on, Joseph begins to realize that's what this is all about. Everything I went through, that God was just setting it up so that the people could be preserved. And so that the Israelite nation could be born. And the Messiah eventually could come through this nation. And so it's all providential. And it really begins to get into high gear right here in Genesis 42. Yeah.
It seems as though Joseph did have some knowledge of this was going to come to pass. Because over in chapter 45 and verse 5, he says, this is God's plan. Don't blame yourselves. This is God's plan. So yeah. It seems as though from that statement, he knew. Probably didn't know all of it, but
he put it together.
He seemed to know that this is all God's plan, that they'd meet up again.
Yes. He put it together. Now, when he put it together, it may have been a little later than this, but he eventually realizes, you know, that this is all the providence of God. And so, well, we don't have much time here, but just the first few verses of 42. When Jacob, this is sort of interesting here, when Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you look at one another? That's almost humorous there. Like, Jacob knew, you know, people were going to Egypt because that's where the food was. And if Jacob knew that, who else knew that? Who? The sons, they knew that. So Jacob's like, what are you doing just standing around looking at each other? Yeah, go to Egypt and get us some food. Like this, their lives are being threatened. They need help. And there wasn't a lot of options. In fact, there was just one. And that is, somehow or another, we're going to have to get to Egypt and get some food. They can't even be sure Egypt would give them any food. But, you know, maybe they have heard, you know, people were buying and they were giving food, whatever. The sons, it's like they're paralyzed by this affliction. Right? They're the very opposite of Joseph. Joseph, in times of affliction, he was a man of action. They're just like, you know, what in the world are we going to do? Jacob's like, what are you standing around looking for? Go to Egypt. Get us some food. And so verse 2 says that, and he said, behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. So I guess he did know. He did hear that. So go down and buy grain for us there that we may live and not die. So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. What did that tell you right there? Anything? How about that? It doesn't seem like Jacob has learned a whole lot over the years, does it? Still showing favorites. You know, what does seem to have changed a little bit, it doesn't seem like in the rest of the narrative at any point in time, the brothers make a big deal about it. And, you know, and listen, you understand, why was Benjamin now his favorite? Huh? Right. That's exactly right. He's the only one left to remind him of Rachel, the wife he loved the most. And Joseph's gone. She's gone, of course. There's just Benjamin. And so we understand. Don't you? I understand that. But he could have been a little discreet about it. Doesn't seem like he again learned from the past. He's not very discreet about it. But it doesn't seem like it affects the brothers a whole lot. So he keeps them behind. That might even suggest he really doesn't trust the oversight of his other sons, you know, to take care of his youngest son. Why in the world wouldn't he trust them to do it? These are grown men now, probably some in their 50s or whatever. You mean Benjamin wouldn't be okay in their care? Why not? Yeah, that's exactly right. Last time I sent my favorite with you all, he didn't come back. So he won't send Benjamin. And that plays a part here just in a little bit as well. All right, we'll pick up there next week.